Robinson is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, where she's produced all the music issues and written the key music pieces over the last 10 years. She was a longtime music columnist for the New York Post and several rock magazines that defined the music scene in the 1970s. A pioneering female journalist in what was then an exclusive boys' club, Lisa traveled with the Stones, Led Zeppelin, and others, and was a confidant of John Lennon, Patti Smith, U2, and Michael Jackson. She introduced Lou Reed to David Bowie. She's the reason why Elvis Costello and The Clash got record deals. The book goes on to offer up an insider's look at Eminem, Lady Gaga, and Jay-Z. Today, we'll speak with Lisa about her new book, There Goes Gravity, A Life in Rock and Roll, which some critics have called an all-access pass to the golden age of rock. Welcome, Lisa, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me.
Early on in the book, you describe your difference as a music journalist. You were not a critic, and you wrote gossipy columns. In fact, Mick Jagger said your writing was not bitchy enough. How did your career evolve?
My career just happened. It was really like what Keith Richards says is a lucky accident. You know, it was a time when things really just happened and you could hang out. My husband at the time was writing a syndicated column. He was on the radio. He had a column in England. I write about this in the book in detail. He didn't want to write the column anymore. He turned it over to me, and one thing after another just sort of fell into place.
Right. When you traveled with the Stones, you shared it was Keith who interested you the most. How so?
Keith was the most elusive and the most mysterious, and I always wanted to do the interview that was the harder one to get. It was the same thing, basically, with Led Zeppelin. Jimmy Page was that way. Even when I was on the road much later with Van Halen, Eddie Van Halen was that way. I mean, it tended to be the one who was more on drugs, who was a little more mysterious and elusive. And at that time, Keith just kept to himself, and he didn't do a lot of press, and Mick sort of bore the burden of all of that. But of course, that made Keith much more fascinating to me. And then years later, when Keith kicked heroin, and you really could find out what he was like, and I spent hours and hours with him over 20 years talking, and he's just incredibly insightful and lucid and brilliant and funny and wonderful.
Let's talk about drugs for a moment. Well, they muse how drugs impacted the music of the 70s. Would the music have been the same had there not been those excesses? What's your feeling?
I have absolutely no idea. You know, there are many musicians who felt that a lot of those drugs fueled their creativity, especially psychedelics, maybe marijuana. I certainly don't feel that any hard drugs ever made anybody any better. Certainly not heroin, and certainly not cocaine. People were babbling idiots on cocaine. I never found it to be attractive. I never tried it. I never wanted to. It just wasn't part of my relationship to this world. You know, there were times when I was on a completely different tour because I was really there for the music. I wasn't there for the party.
Right. You once asked Mick Jagger what was the most important thing in a rock band, and he answered the drummer. So talk about John Bonham.
John Bonham was, I think, the best drummer ever in rock and roll because he just had an incredible feel. He was influenced by Motown. He was influenced by R&B. I mean, now I could name many, many other drummers who I think are incredible. Questlove and The Roots, I think, is amazing. Steve Jordan is amazing. Charlie Watts is a great drummer, more of a jazz drummer. But John Bonham was very, very underrated at the time. He also did that 20-minute solo Moby Dick that I could have lived without because I wasn't ever a big fan of drum solos. But at the time, and I write about this a lot in the book, he was in a fury because he came in after Karen Carpenter in a Playboy drummer poll. I think it was in 1975, and he was really, his feelings were really hurt by that. And John Bonham had the reputation of being like sort of a maniac. When he got drunk or stoned, he was wild and violent. But I knew him to be a really sweet guy. When he did an interview with me once, he came, knocked on my hotel room door, and he was wearing a suit. And at the time, he would always open car doors for me and light cigarettes for me. And I just was incredibly fond of him.
Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones were so gifted. Why do you think the rock press played down their influence and seemed to really have it against Led Zeppelin?
When Led Zeppelin first came to America, they were really considered a cheesy heavy metal band by a lot of my so-called colleagues who were very, very serious rock critics. But when I saw them for the first time in Jacksonville, Florida, I think it was in 1973, I fell in love with their music because I heard all these different influences. I heard the blues, I heard Eastern music, I heard the incredible string band, Kaleidoscope, folk music, Joni Mitchell, Fairport Convention. And because I was so informed about all this music, when I sat down and talked to them and I started talking about all these different influences, that immediately impressed them, I guess, to the point where they felt that I was a kindred spirit and I got what they were trying to do, and that's why they had me around them as much as they did.
It was amusing to read in your book that in the mid-70s, some of the bands, several of which are still touring today, were being written about then as being washed up. In your
opinion, dinosaurs, yes. Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Who, Pink Floyd, all of them, because of punk rock, I think. Because what happened in the mid-70s, when all the punk rock bands cut their hair, and it was very loud, fast, noisy music, all of them just kind of, you know, it's like similar to like what happened in the 1990s when Nirvana and Soundgarden and Pearl Jam came along. It just made all those other bands like Warrant and Poison and those Bang Tangos, those kind of bands, it just put them out of business. Now, it didn't put the Stones and the Who out of business, or Led Zeppelin, Lord knows, because their music certainly has withstood the test of time and they're still performing and people still want to see them. But there was a moment there where those bands, even when they were in their 30s, got nervous.
Yeah. Well, time told a different story. I was fascinated to read that Michael Jackson had a completely different voice when talking in public. He actually spoke normally. Did you ever ask him why he employed that affectation?
You know, I never really did, because when I spoke to him, he spoke normally, and then occasionally I would hear him go off into that sort of higher, whispery thing. I think it was just both sides of his personality. It really never occurred to me so much until I looked back at it, or I listened back to some of my tapes and I wrote about it for this book, that certainly when he talked to a lawyer or a record company executive, he was much more forceful. He was very much in control of his career. He knew what he was doing.
You know, in the book, you seem to be a bit conflicted about Bono, in that he embraced the music. They didn't want to be sort of the establishment. And then years later, he's up for the Nobel Peace Prize and living in the south of France. Talk about that.
Well, I've always had an issue with Bono because of his association with President Bush. I always felt that artists should not go to that White House. And we argued about it all the time, although Bono would always say it wasn't an argument, it was a debate. And I have a lot about this in the book. He said to me, Irish people debate, we don't argue. And we just always agreed to disagree about it. I don't know that it's a question of being a member of the establishment, because he's still an artist, he's still a musician, he's a songwriter, he's a performer. But, you know, I do go into this a lot in the book about the stages of success that bands have, from stage one to stage four, when they start off driving in a van or sleeping on people's floors, and then by the time they get to stage four, they're in the private planes with the grass-fed beef and the private chefs and the trainers and the trunks of costumes. And I just trace the trajectory of that.
Yeah. Lisa, the book was really fascinating. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
All righty. Bye.